I want to begin again this week with the lyrics of a song, and this time with one of the songs that we've just heard, and thanks to Brad for pulling that together. These are the words that we heard in that Shaker song. "'Tis the gift to be simple, 'tis the gift to be free, 'tis the gift to come down where we ought to be, and when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend we shan't be ashamed, to turn will be our delight, till by turning we come out right." Well, this song is attributed to a person named Joseph Brackett, who was an elder in that Christian group known as the Shakers, which reached its zenith in the middle of the 19th century. And one of the features of Shaker life, Shaker culture, was hard work and a simple lifestyle. We see that Brackett's song celebrates simplicity, which is identified as a gift. 'Tis the gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in a place just right, to all be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, we come out right. For the Shakers, simplicity is a Christian virtue. And I think that the Shakers were correct in this. The Christian tradition and the biblical tradition as a whole sees something beautiful, something precious in that which is simple, small, and vulnerable. Now, in one sense, this is surprising, because the natural order, which we call creation, appears to operate on the basis of a principle that scientists often call the survival of the fittest. And it certainly does appear that creation evolves in keeping with this principle. Even we humans have evolved by means of this principle. Nature takes its course by rewarding the big and the smart and the strong. It is such specimens that survive and thrive. More often than not, the weak and the not-so-smart specimens have a hard time and eventually fade out of the picture. Now, we might think that if this is indeed the natural order of creation, that the Creator would be pleased with it all and take special delight in whatever is big and strong and successful in the world. But surprisingly, at least when it comes to humanity, God seems to show a preference for the weak, the small, and the disadvantaged. Time and time again in the stories of the Bible, it is the little one who is chosen. Number two instead of number one, the runt of the litter, the one forgotten by the mainstream. And so it is that Jacob, who is second born, is chosen over Esau, the firstborn, to become Israel, the patriarch of the people of God. And when it came time for a king to consolidate the 12 tribes of Israel, the most successful was David, who was the youngest child of an obscure family from the smallest tribe, and he was chosen for this task. And of course, Israel itself is a rather obscure little nation in the ancient Near East, a tiny little country compared to the empires of Egypt and Assyria and Babylonia. Time and time again in the scriptures of Israel, we read that God cares deeply for the little folk who are disadvantaged and disenfranchised by the natural evolution of the economy and the political system, where the big and the strong keep on rising to the top. And it seems that the same God who set the natural order in motion is not always happy with the way it tends to play itself out. Evidently, God's human creatures are then given a mandate, when we think about our own relation to this and our own ministry as people of faith. It seems then that we're given a mandate to keep things in balance, to do what we can to alleviate poverty, disease, to address injustice, inequity, to make sure that there's no discrimination against the small and the weak. Something quite the opposite of the survival of the fittest. It's not easy for us to put this moral mandate into practice. The survival of the fittest is literally built into our genes. In spite of our attempts to convince ourselves otherwise, deep down we still think that size really does matter. We measure how good something is by its size. We measure things on a scale of 1 to 10. What's the best? Well, 10, the biggest number. The biggest political party with the most votes gets to run the country. The country with the biggest military and the most money gets to run the world. In business, bigger is supposed to be better. In our personal lives, we strive for a bigger house, a bigger salary, a bigger nest egg for our retirement. We're so thoroughly immersed in the doctrine of size matters that we even worry about personal body parts that may or may not measure up. Now, over against this bigger is better agenda, our faith tells us that small things count. And occasionally there have been people who have taken this seriously. 30 years ago, in 1973, a British economist called E.F. Schumacher wrote a book called Small is Beautiful. The subtitle of the book is Economics as if People Mattered. The book sold more than 700,000 copies and was hailed as one of the most important books of the century. I remember it well because in 1973, I was beginning my studies for ministry. And I read Schumacher's book as if it was one of my theology textbooks. It seemed to resonate closely with what Jesus has to say. Schumacher wanted the economy to serve human beings, not the other way around. Jesus said, the Sabbath was made for human beings, not human beings for the Sabbath. Schumacher wanted small-scale, decentralized, people-centered technologies, economics from the heart rather than from the bottom line. Jesus said, where your heart is, that is where your treasure will be also. Schumacher insisted that small things count and that small is beautiful. There's still a Schumacher society in North America, and there are still some Schumacher fans around. I suppose that I'm a living example. But generally speaking, we seem to have forgotten about him. And needless to say, neither Schumacher nor Jesus were successful in transforming the world into an economy from the heart, where ordinary human beings matter more than the economic powers that be. We live in a competitive world where we like to measure how great things are. In our lives and in our work, we tend to strive for greatness, just like those disciples of Jesus who argued with each other about who was the greatest, who was the most important. Jesus responds and by drawing attention away from the argument and draws attention instead to a child. Why don't we lift up this child in our midst and forget our individual concerns about being important? There is no one more important than this little one. Take this little one in your arms, and you have the opportunity to blossom as a human being as you care for this little child. Such caring, if it is done respectfully and faithfully, will bring out the very best in you. It will bring out the greatest in you. And of course, the same is true for any ministry that responds to the needs of those who are most fragile and most disadvantaged. Followers of Jesus who are greatest in the eyes of God are those who turn their attention and their loving service to the ones who are least fit of all. Deep down we know this, don't we? That's why we acknowledge persons like Mother Teresa and Jean Vanier to be the truly great ones of the Christian faith. But believing is one thing, and knowing is another. Believing is more than knowing. And in the true sense of the word, believing also includes a passionate trusting in that which is believed. In its most noble form, it means that a person would entrust their life to the truth of a belief, and even give up their life for it. And that is, of course, exactly what Jesus did. And interestingly enough, significantly enough, our gospel reading today includes a reference to the death of Jesus. Scholars who look at the Gospels, scholars of Mark, call this a prediction of Jesus' passion. And there are three of these so-called predictions, and they're connected with three conversations between disciples and Jesus, and that's most significant, because these conversations are about the essence of Jesus' identity, the essence of Christian ministry. We heard the first conversation last week, in which Jesus asked the disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" And after some wrong answers from the disciples, the essence of Jesus' answer is to talk about his willingness to lose his life for the sake of the gospel. The second prediction comes in our reading this week, and here it's linked with the conversation about achieving greatness in the appreciation of the small and the vulnerable. The third prediction is connected with a conversation about hierarchy in the disciples' circle. James and John want to be top dogs, and Jesus tells them they don't know what they're asking. That the only way to that sort of place is through a willingness to walk with Jesus into the likely scenario of having to die for the cause of the gospel. So we see the common thread there in these three conversations about hierarchy and greatness, and always referring again to what's coming in Jesus' own life. In reading the Gospels carefully, it soon becomes clear that the cause of the Gospel is closely connected to the creation of a community. God's kingdom, as we like to call it here at TSB. A community in which everyone has a place at the table, and especially the little ones, the disenfranchised, the poor, the vulnerable. We know this picture. But again, can we believe that it is real? That it can be a reality in this dog-eat-dog survival of the fittest world of ours. And of course, we need faith in order to believe in the reality of the gospel. Last week, one or two people said to me, in effect, "Thanks for helping me understand what I don't believe," which was, if you remember, the orthodox dogma of the church. "But now, how about helping me understand what I do believe? What I can believe, and how to get there?" Of course, that's not so easy. But I'm suggesting this week that Jesus invites us to believe in the kingdom of God, the reign of God in our lives and in our community life, in such a way that we begin to exercise radical hospitality and genuine love. What do we do then, and how do we get there? Well, perhaps the first principle is to remember that small is beautiful. And often our faith is most genuinely expressed in small acts of compassion and small steps in peace and justice making. And typically, the most faithful practitioners of the gospel are hardly aware they are doing so well. And eventually, passion for the gospel becomes second nature. I do believe, and remember the true meaning of that word, I do believe that something is required over and above the exercise of gospel principles. And that requirement is a gospel character. The incorporation of beatitude, if you will. And I believe that such incorporation comes with the spiritual discipline of devotional experience. We don't talk about that so much in the United Church, and perhaps especially here at TSP. But if I didn't think that it had to do with devotional experience, I wouldn't bother with church, especially given the church's many institutional obstacles to the gospel. And essentially what we do in devotional practice is to open ourselves up to receiving spiritual energy and spiritual gifts from a source outside of ourselves. Maybe that source is also within, but essentially its origin is outside of ourselves. Ultimately, the resources that we need to move from knowing the good to believing the good, these resources are gifts of the Spirit. And that Spirit is the same Spirit in which Jesus set the gospel pattern, then lived it out, died for it, and continues to radiate its essence in a resurrected presence among us. So a central mandate for us then, a core gospel invitation, urges us to ask for the gifts of the Spirit, to pray for them, till we know and believe 'tis a gift to be simple. 'Tis a gift to be loving. 'Tis a gift to have courage. 'Tis a gift to have hope. 'Tis a gift to hang in there. 'Tis a gift to be patient. 'Tis a gift to strive for justice. 'Tis a gift to be kind. 'Tis a gift to keep the faith. The Shakers literally danced with the gifts of the Spirit. They danced with devotional passion. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend, we shan't be ashamed. To turn will be our delight, till by turning, we come out right. So be it. Amen.